Muscles are in the news today, mouse muscles, but with vast implications for human muscles. Researchers at the Salk Institute in San Diego just reported that they found two drugs that give mice the benefits of exercise without having to exert themselves. So we thought that we would talk about muscles on this week's Please Explain, how they work, how to build them, and how they can break down. And joining me now is Dr. Todd Schroeder, who teaches clinical exercise physiology at the University of Southern California. Welcome to our show.
Hello, thank you.
Were you surprised by the Salk Institute report?
No, that research has been carried on for a number of years now. What the difficulty has been is succeeding similar findings in humans, and it's interesting. Certainly, there's still a lot to be learned about muscle, and we can move forward with that. But there's the implications in humans, although, there's a lot of talk about, are athletes going to be using this particular drug? It's called ICAR is how you refer to it in this upcoming Olympics to get some performance enhancement. But, there's not enough known about it and that it could really work in humans in the same way that it's working in animal models, being particularly mice and rat models.
Part of the problem with something like this is that it can be very effective with mice, but then you don't want to necessarily test it out on humans until you're sure that it won't cause any major problems. But how can a drug mimic the effects of exercise?
Well, it can potentially mimic some effects of exercise. It might have a very specific effect in muscle and as far as exercise-related effects, but on the rest of the body, it may do absolutely nothing, as far as hormones, the immune system, cardiovascular system, and that's even some of what I think they've mentioned with the findings of this study, that previous studies with ICAR in humans for like diabetes and obesity, trying to show that it burns fat better, than you can with exercise even alone, and that it hasn't really been successful to use in humans for that purpose. With animal models like mice, you can give much, much higher doses than you would do in a human, because you don't know the risks, and some athletes are willing to take that chance and go beyond what a medical doctor would prescribe, or work with somebody on a research team and give actual subjects or participants. But so there's some aspects that might be enhanced by taking a drug like this related to performance and exercise, but the average person would not benefit for overall health by taking something like this, at least at this time. I mean, certainly there's potential with it, and someday we're going to have, compounds that will be quite effective for overall health, but I don't think we're there yet.
Well, it sounds quite seductive, but also seems a bit obscene to think that you could be a couch potato, take a pill, and develop muscles. Well, maybe we should go back to basics. How does science define muscle?
Classically, muscles are a metabolically active tissue that results in moving of bones, and so it's required for movement. And to get the skeleton to move, you have to have muscles. Now, there's many other implications of muscle. I mean, it's a reservoir or storage for substrates like carbohydrate and fat that you use for energy. It stores hormones that help regulate other things in the body, even influences the immune system. And so, muscles extremely important for many other things, particularly in cases of disease. Muscle stores high amounts of protein, as most people are familiar with muscle being protein, but it's very important in disease states. People with HIV, cancer patients, patients that have received a lot of trauma from burns, the muscle acts as a reservoir for proteins to make new white blood cells or leukocytes to help fight off infection and to basically repair the body. So muscle is very important besides just locomotion or being able to move around.
But we're talking about muscles as though they're just one thing, aren't they? What you're saying suggests there are many different types of muscles in the body.
Yeah, well, I mean, classify muscles either skeletal muscle, which is the muscle that typically you have in your arms, your legs, your chest muscles that help you with movement and all. And then you have basically smooth muscle, which is a little bit different, and that's in like the intestines, helps with digestion and things like that. And then the third primary type would be cardiac muscle or your heart muscle. And, you know, they all have slight distinct characteristics on how they function. Most people think of muscle as skeletal muscle, that which you use for movement and all. And but then even broken down beyond that, you have different fiber types or isoforms of the muscle, and they have particular characteristics that allow you to either perform, you know, a certain task with greater force or more power, but you fatigue quicker, as opposed to other fibers that allow you to go for long distances, like endurance type things, and not fatigue as quick. And, you know, everyone, this is kind of dictated by genetics. Everybody has kind of a genetic predisposition towards more of one type of fiber than another, and that's how even athletes will self-select into sport, whether they're going to be an endurance runner or a sprinter or a power lifter. You know, it really varies. And you can look at somebody and get an idea of kind of their genetic makeup. What you can't see is the fibers themselves. You need to do a muscle biopsy to actually determine their fiber types and get a better idea of, you know, how they're made.
My guest is Dr. Todd Schroeder, who teaches clinical exercise physiology to physical therapy and medical students at the University of Southern California. He's our guest on today's Please Explain on the Leonard Lopez Show on WNYC, WNYC.org. I was always jealous of a guy in college who did no exercise, nothing, and yet he was really muscly, and others out there would lift weights and try really hard to look as good as Richard did and never really were able to succeed. So as you say, we are also born with certain musculature. But what about these muscles that you mentioned, the skeletal, the smooth, and cardiac? Do they have different compositions, or are they all just variations of the same thing?
For the most part, they're variations of the same thing. I mean, they have slight differences in the nuclei and the characteristics, kind of the what we call the myogenic regulators, the different proteins within the muscle that regulate how it works or dictates its characteristic and how it functions. You know, a heart continues to beat for long periods of time, and the myocytes or cardiac cells are slightly different than skeletal muscle. And how it adapts. I mean, certainly a heart that works harder, like an athlete's, that it pumps stronger and more often, it's going to get bigger or hypertrophy. And, you know, that's a characteristic that you also see in skeletal muscle. You know, when you work out, you lift weights, that muscle gets bigger. And from the repetitive loading or intensity on the muscle, and that's a common adaptation. Of course, like you mentioned, your friend, some people get bigger than others, and some people are born with more muscle mass than others. And again, that has a lot to do with the genetic regulation of some of these proteins. And there's a number of proteins that have been isolated that have made media attention over the last couple years. But, you know, a lot of people think of testosterone and getting more testosterone to make bigger muscles. And in the next few years, testosterone is going to be obsolete, and there's going to be these other compounds and certain proteins that are inhibited or turned on genetically that will create a lot more muscle mass in people that normally don't have a lot of muscle mass. And that's going to be great for medicine and clinical treatments and individuals that need to put on muscle, but it's also going to alter, you know, sports and sport doping and that kind of thing.
Well, we had steroids. That was the previous standard, but they've been banned because they had negative effects or because it was considered unfair?
Yeah, well, it's both the issues. I mean, most physicians and medical individuals will say there are side effects that are detrimental by taking, you know, too many steroids or at least not controlled. And but the other side of that is, you know, we need it for medicine and all, but the ethical issues dealing with, you know, it gives somebody an edge in sport where someone else is not getting that edge because they're staying clean and not going to that next level and trying to improve their performance slightly with some drug or steroid.
Can we divide muscles into voluntary and involuntary?
Yeah, certainly. Skeletal muscle, for the most part, is voluntary as far as, you know, contracting, and it's how the nervous system innervates it. I mean, like the diaphragm, which helps you breathe, is considered a skeletal muscle, but it's really controlled involuntarily. You don't think about contracting and not relaxing your diaphragm to breathe. It does that on its own. But if you want to take a deeper breath, you certainly can. And so you can override, you know, involuntary control of skeletal muscle, but most of it's voluntary.
How does that work? How do muscles send feedback to the brain? How does the central nervous system send commands to the involuntary muscles?
Yeah, well, that's you know, important because the nervous system, well, let's just say the muscles are nothing without the nervous system. And in fact, the nervous system dictates the characteristics of muscle and how it functions. So depending upon the type of nerve that goes to the muscle is really going to be how it responds.
So different nerves go to different kinds of muscle?
Yeah, different types of nerves and the innervation of those nerves and how many nerves go to that particular muscle. You call that the motor unit is the muscle fiber and the nerve that innervates it. And so if you have many more nerves going to that muscle, you have much more fine motor control. So you can be, you know, do like your hands have a lot, the muscles in your hands have a lot of nerves going to them. So you have very fine control as opposed to like a big quadricep muscle in the front of your leg. You have less nerves going to the fibers. You might have more fibers overall, but you have less nerves going to them because you don't need that fine control of the muscle. It's just contract it and get the action, whereas your fingers you want to be delicate with. Facial muscles have a lot of nerves in it, so you have better control.
Well, for voluntary muscle fibers, there are two distinctions, aren't there? Slow twitch and fast twitch?
Yes.
What is the difference there, and what gives slow twitch muscles a very rich red color?
Yeah, the red color with a slow twitch muscle fiber is the myoglobin, and that's the basically the protein like hemoglobin. It holds oxygen, and so slow twitch fibers use a lot of oxygen efficiently. And so, I mean, think of it, an endurance athlete, someone who can run a long distance rather well, has more slow twitch fibers than somebody who is more prone to being like a sprinter. They would have more fast twitch fibers, and that's what used to refer to as fast twitch being white type fibers. They have the less oxygen carrying capacity in them, and slow twitch fibers are the red fibers. They have more oxygen rich tissue, and but it's a big difference in that the fast twitch fibers are very force producing. You can produce a lot of force very quickly, but they fatigue very quickly as well. And contrary to that is this slow twitch or the red fibers that they don't fatigue quickly. They don't produce as much force, but they can contract over a long period of time based on their ability to use oxygen.
Can we choose which kind to develop? Are there certain exercises that you do for slow twitch and others for fast twitch?
For the most part, no. In humans, if you train, you can transform some of the fast twitch fibers to what we call a more oxidative fiber, or that uses oxygen a bit better, but it will not transition completely to a slow twitch fiber or the red type fiber. You can in animal models, again, they show some of that, but human evidence is not good that you can transition from one fiber type to another. You can transition within that fiber type, which helps you a little bit. If you're a runner and you run a lot, you might transition from more force-producing fibers to some that carry, you know, can use a little more oxygen, but they're not going to transition completely into a slow twitch or red-type fiber.
We're going to be taking listener calls in just a few moments. Our number here is 646-778-3729. That's 646-778-3729. But just before we go to a break, can you take us through the process of contraction? I just flexed my bicep. What happened other than the fact that I impressed my audio engineer?
Well, you know, it starts in the nervous system and sends an impulse through down your spinal column, which will, you know, run out somewhere, you know, near the shoulder area, and it goes down the nerve and reaches your bicep, and that actually, called the action potential, stimulates the release of some chemical transmitters, which we call acetylcholine, and you know, that then is released from the nerve onto the basically the muscle membrane there where the fibers are, and will stimulate what we call an electrochemical reaction, and it's basically taken through the muscle by changes in the ions or sodium and potassium within the muscle, and it kind of carries this electrical charge into the muscle, and then that electrical charge is basically converted into a mechanical energy, and that's through some special proteins within the muscle, which a lot of people have heard of, myosin and actin. But if you release some certain proteins there, you stimulate the myosin and actin with what we call ATP, or the adenosine triphosphate, and that's the energy within the muscle. And that's released, which causes the myosin and actin to pull on each other so that you get contraction. And there's thousands of these myosin and actin proteins that are using the energy of ATP to make these little tiny ratchets. And if you put all these little ratchet actions together, it creates a movement of the muscle.
Although it's like a miracle because it's so instantaneous. I think it, and the next second I have a flexed muscle.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it happens within milliseconds, but there's many, many hundreds of changes that are going on for that to occur that we don't even have to think about. It just happens, which is incredible.
We're going to take a little break and take listener calls. Our number is 646-778-3729. You can also leave a message on our comment line at WNYC.org. My guest is Dr. Todd Schroeder, who is teaches clinical exercise physiology to physical therapy and medical students at the University of Southern California. We're talking about muscles on today's Please Explain. Stay with us. And we are back with Dr. Todd Schroeder. We're talking about muscles on today's Please Explain, and let's get right to your calls. Gregory from Park Slope, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for taking the call. I was very curious about what you guys were talking about involuntary muscles and voluntary muscles, and I was curious about more sort of specific, the technical information that he was talking about, the innervation of the muscles and how, like, for example, the diaphragm is mostly involuntary, but then we can make it voluntary, and how does that innervation process work, and sort of the continuum of voluntary to involuntary, the heart's involuntary. I'm a performance artist in theater and dance, and the question of making the involuntary voluntary is very interesting to me.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good question. And some people are more capable of having voluntary control of what is normally involuntary control of the muscles. And, you know, like, for instance, your heart rate. Some people are very good at, you know, slowing their heart rate just through kind of a meditation process, but they can actually basically trigger the nervous system, at least the particular nerves that are innervating the heart, and you have kind of your what's called parasympathetic and sympathetic. The sympathetic results in a faster heart rate, whereas parasympathetic helps to slow the heart rate. And some individuals are able to control those voluntarily better than others. And, you know, some people really don't have much control of that at all. But that's why people that are able to control their heart rate and breathing, you know, those kind of free diving divers that free dive for, you know, hundreds of feet and basically do a meditation type state, they're able to control their heart rate and very specifically through voluntary control what most people can't because it's involuntarily controlled. You have the innervation to, you know, the muscle to do this, but most people just can't do it, and it takes concentration and training, and some people can never learn to do it well.
And it's part of a tradition that we find more in Asia than we do here. Yogis seem to be able to do a lot of that stuff. Ellen from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Ellen.
How are you?
Hello.
You there?
Yes, Ellen.
Sorry, how are you? My question is it possible for someone to be a mixture of fast and slow twitch muscle? The reason I ask is because I've been an athlete pretty much my entire life, but for 15 years I was a long-distance runner and was very successful at it. And 15 years later, after getting tired of running, I became a strength athlete, and now I'm a power lifter. And I've been very successful at that, too. So I've gone the spectrum from being a slow twitch aerobic athlete to a fast twitch anaerobic athlete, and have been successful in both sports. And I was just wondering if it's possible for someone to have that type of muscle fiber mixture.
Yes, I mean, that's a great question, and absolutely. Most people have a mixture of the fiber types, the slow and the fast twitch, and usually it's kind of a 45-50% of one and, you know, 45 or 50% of the other, or whatever. But the difference is in high end level athletes, they will have predominantly more of one fiber than another, and that really doesn't change even if you switch the particular sports that you're doing. It sounds like that you've been successful at both types of sports, which is wonderful, and you probably are, you know, a 50-50 in fiber types. But, you know, it really varies between individuals. Again, it's kind of dictated by genetics. And but most people we see are like 45% slow twitch and 55% fast twitch or vice versa.
But why does something like weightlifting build more muscles than long-distance running?
Yeah, you know, it really depends on the load that the muscle feels. I mean, you never see a marathon runner that's a 250-pound 5%, you know, muscle-bound individual. They're usually very lightweight. Although they're lean, they have low fat. The repetitive training you would do for, you know, running, you just can't get the muscle to build. It takes intensity of loading to do that, and that's where with strength training and putting the muscle through these high loads, it will adapt by adding more proteins within the existing fibers to hypertrophy. But, you know, runners, you wouldn't want to carry more mass over a long distance, so the body's pretty good at recognizing that. And while it becomes very lean and reduces fat, you really don't build a lot of muscle mass with endurance-type training.
What's happening on a physiological level when we become fatigued? What leads to that soreness you get after an intense physical workout?
Well, that's a very good question as well, because most people think it's lactate or lactic acid that results in their pain that they feel after exercise, and it is not. Lactate is cleared very quickly in the body within minutes generally, but it's the muscle damage we call it, you know, muscle disruption or damage or muscle injury. And it's a very important part of the adaptation process. If you work out with weights and you get sore a day or two later, or you just started a new exercise program, maybe it's kickboxing or you know, aerobics, or you just went hiking where there's a lot of downhill. Usually when you hike, you go up and you got to come down, and that creates muscle damage because of the muscle actually tearing. You can think of it as the fibers tearing a little bit, and although it's minor, it does give you pain, but it stimulates the muscle to rebuild and make bigger, stronger fibers, and that's how you get hypertrophy. And in the end, you won't feel soreness after a couple weeks of doing the same activity. You adapt to it. So it's a really neat process, but it is muscle damage that causes soreness. It is not lactic acid or the lactate that builds up.
Well, I've been told that for muscles to really get big, they need to be worked to the breaking point and even torn, and then they'll heal and become bigger during periods of rest. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. We try and
so that's what Arnold Schwarzenegger, that's what bodybuilders do?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you have to really, you think of it as tearing down the muscle. Now, in a whole muscle, this is microscopic damage that is occurring, so it's not like you're actually pulling a muscle in half. You're tearing little fibers throughout the muscle, and that stimulates it to rebuild with more protein and to make it stronger and to resist future breakdown or tearing from that same type exercise, and which gets you in shape but also builds more muscle mass.
We're talking with Dr. Todd Schroeder of the University of Southern California on today's Please Explain, and taking your calls at 646-778-3729. Peter from Chappaqua. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I'm a 63-year-old man who works out every day and lifts weight. And I have two boys at around 20. Yet, when they don't do anything, they can still outperform me. Why? What happens to my muscles that I? They sort of degenerate. Why the boys seem to get stronger?
Yeah. No. Well, that's a great question. In fact, my focus and research is improving strength and function in older adults, and we do that through resistance training and hormone supplementation from, you know, studies with testosterone and growth hormone. But everybody, as they age, will lose muscle mass, and it's basically, well, it's termed sarcopenia, and it's the loss of muscle and associated strength with aging. And it's related to a number of factors, from diet, not getting enough protein, to a sedentary lifestyle, to changes in the nervous system, changes in hormones, like, you know, a decline in testosterone after 30 or 40 in men, testosterone declines. So there's a whole host of factors that influence this loss of muscle mass, and it's important to stay active. And in fact, we're very big supporters of resistance training in older adults to maintain muscle mass and strength. Certainly, you know, if you supplement a low testosterone with more testosterone and resistance training, you can get a better effect than just resistance training alone. But you do not have the same anabolic environment as a 20-year-old as you do when you're 63, but that's not to say you can't get improvements. And in fact, a study in older adults, they used they were 87 to like 94-year-old adult men, and resistance trained for 12 weeks, and they showed that you had 174% improvement in strength, but only a 10% improvement in muscle mass. Now, what that suggests is that you really are training the nervous system to contract the muscle fibers you have at a very high level. It's not that you're increasing your muscle mass and you have more mass to contribute to that force production. And so that's a lot of what we see in older adults. They can get stronger through the nervous system adaptations, but they really don't get as much muscle mass as someone who's younger and has that.
Even if we take supplements and do other things.
Yeah, I mean, it's helpful, but you're not going to have that typical young look, you know, bodybuilder type You know, and everyone's a little bit different. There are some older adults that are in incredible shape. You know, a lot of muscle mass. They look better than some 20-year-olds. But for the average person, it is difficult to achieve that based on the changes in the physiology of, you know, an aging human being. So.
A few people have written in. In fact, a number of people have written in, and I just want to address a few of their concerns. One person wants to know, why do we carry tension in certain muscles more than others? Your neck gets tense, but not your leg muscle, although I guess some people get twitchy leg muscles as well when they're tense.
Yeah, no, that's true, and a lot of it has to do with positioning and your occupation or your job, whether you're sitting a lot or you're standing. People that stand a lot, they have to continue to contract their muscles to get blood flow. Otherwise, they can often, you probably hear of military people passing out that stand at attention for long periods of time. But it's important to get, you know, the blood in the lower extremities moving, so you need to contract your muscles. And so some are more tense depending upon your positioning. If you sit at a desk all day, your legs are going to be relatively relaxed, and your neck and shoulder muscles might be tight. And so it really depends on your positioning for the period of time, whatever your occupation is or whatever you do. So,
a listener wants to know if there are major gender differences when it comes to muscles.
Yeah, that's it's always a hard one, because skeletal muscle between men and women is identical in how it works, and all the way down to the cross bridge of the proteins, the myosin and actin, and the force they produce is identical between men and women's muscle. But there are other things that are different, from the hormones between men and women and how they distribute their muscle mass and their body composition. And so men tend to be stronger in the upper body, and there are studies have demonstrated this, and whereas women actually are stronger than men in the legs if you correct for the amount of muscle mass they have.
Now, we have very little time, but I just wanted to ask you in 10 seconds, what is muscle memory?
Well, muscle memory is not the muscle itself. It's the nervous system, and the nervous system learns a certain motor pattern and can remember that. And so that's when we talk about muscle memory and being able to maintain strength even when you've stopped training. It's really the nervous system has learned a motor pattern on how it activates the muscle and remembers that when you come back to do that same type of activity.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us on today's Please Explain. My guest has been Dr. Todd Schroeder, who teaches clinical exercise physiology to physical therapy and medical students at the University of Southern California. Thank you so much.
Thank you.